Welcome to everyone gathered in this place and to everyone watching or listening online. So glad we can all be together today. If you would please turn in your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 27. We will continue to work through the story of David. Last week after our gathering, someone asked me out back, how do you determine what you're going to preach about when you're working through such a long narrative like the life of David? And I really appreciated the question because I felt the person who was asking the question recognizes that I am having to make some difficult choices about which scenes and which details and which little stories to include and unpack. And you may notice that I'm skipping over some really good stuff in order to keep the momentum going as we work through this longer story. But I have to make some choices about which stories I pass over as we work through 1 and 2 Samuel. And the answer to that question, just in case you're curious, is that when I read through the story each week, I usually read until I come to something, some detail, some connection that jumps out at me and grabs my attention because it's interesting or profound or convicting or maybe transforming. Some preachers call these attention-grabbing details God moments or God statements. And usually it's these God moments that allow us to hear a word from the Lord in a sermon or in a class or a teaching. And I know that I've stumbled into one of these God moments in my reading when I notice something that makes me stop and say, oh, that'll preach. And these that'll preach moments are sometimes obvious. Everyone knows the story of David and Goliath will preach. Maybe, in fact, we've preached it too much. You're tired of hearing about it, but we know it'll preach. But sometimes getting to these God statements that preach takes a little more time and a little more work. Like last week, I read that David was running away from Saul and he hid in a cave. I think, well, that's an interesting detail. It's really just a single line, one statement. But then when I read the two psalms attributed to David while he was in that cave, I get to go inside David's heart and mind and get a better sense of how he feels about being this all-star, this hero who's driven into hiding by a mad king. And when I make that connection, I think, okay, that will preach. Well, this week, I got to tell you, I have struggled to find something to preach out of the final section in 1 Samuel and the opening section of 2 Samuel. And by the way, 1 and 2 Samuel originally were written as one long story, but they were broken up into two books or two volumes, two parts, because a single scroll couldn't hold the entire story. So we have 1 and 2 Samuel, but it's really just Samuel in two parts. And today I want to spend a few minutes walking you through this middle section of the story of David, the Samuel story, 1 and 2 Samuel, and show you why it's been a challenge to find something to preach. Maybe see if you can come up with something, because I'm not sure I can. Because in 1 Samuel 26, David spares Saul's life a second time. The first time being back in chapter 24, when David and his men were hiding in a cave. Well, 26, David sneaks up on Saul while he's asleep, and he has the opportunity to kill him, and he doesn't. And then later, and in both instances, later, when Saul learns that David could have killed him but spared his life, both times Saul promises to stop chasing David. But given that it happens twice, there's an indication that Saul didn't keep his promise the first time. And he's likely not going to keep his promise the second time. David sees the pattern. So in chapter 27, verse 1, David makes a big change in his life. We read in verse 1, David thought to himself, after Saul makes the promise to leave him alone, one of these days I will be destroyed by the hand of Saul. The best thing I can do is to escape to the land of the Philistines. Israel's enemy. Idol worshipers. And then Saul will give up searching for me anywhere in Israel, and I will slip out of his hand. So what you see in chapter 27 is that David and his men and their families, their wives and their children, they all move in with the Philistines. Those idol-worshiping, awful Philistines. And they live there among the Philistines for 16 months. And David pledges his allegiance to Achish, the king of Gath, who this time, instead of seeing David as a madman, remember that story from last week, now he sees David as a mighty, valuable warrior. And he accepts David as his vassal. David now works for Achish, the king of Gath, of the Philistines, not Israel. And Achish lets David and his men and their families move to Ziklag, a little village where they can keep it as their home base. And from there, if you keep reading, you'll see that from Ziklag, David and his merry men launch a series of raids against the mutual enemies of the Israelites and the Philistines. But David is careful to kill every single person in those settlements so that none of them live to tell Achish what he's up to. And when Achish asks David, hey, where have you been raiding? David lies to him. And he tells him instead, well, I've been raiding settlements in southern Israel in the territory of Judah. In other words, I've been raiding my own people. And this is where we really begin to see David's political acumen and deceptive abilities. Didn't mean to be redundant there. We see it begin to shine. David's deception endears him to Achish, who understands now that if David is really attacking his own people, he can never go back to Israel. And so Achish says in verse 12 of chapter 27, it says, Achish trusted David and said to himself, he has become so obnoxious, some versions say odious, he's become so odious to his people, the Israelites, that he will be my servant for life. So Achish thinks David is with him forever. But it's all based on deception, because what David is actually doing is gaining loyalty in Judah by attacking Judah's enemies. And later on, it will be his popularity in Judah that helps him become king. Playing it so well. Achish loves him. People in Judah love him. Nobody at this point really knows where David stands. And so in chapter 28, Achish and his army line up to fight Saul and his army in yet another round of battle. The Israelites versus the Philistines. And Achish tells David and his men, you're going to fight in this battle with me. And David appears to be ready and willing to go to battle against the Israelites. So much so, and you never really know with David, but so much so, Achish makes David his bodyguard. David is going to be next to the king of Gath of the Philistines while the Philistines fight the Israelites. But then before we see if David really will go to battle against his own people, the narrator cuts from this scene to show us how Saul is preparing for battle. And when Saul sees the Philistines lining up to do battle, he's filled with fear, which is common for Saul. And he inquires of the Lord, looking for some guidance, but he doesn't hear anything from the Lord because the Lord has cut off communication with this king that he's rejected. So Saul, in one of the strangest scenes in all the Bible, and that's saying something, in one of the strangest scenes in all the Bible, he disguises himself and he goes to see a medium. Some translations call her the Witch of Endor, which is kind of cool sounding. He disguises himself and goes to see the Witch of Endor and asks her to bring back Samuel, who at this point in the story is dead. And if you think Samuel was a bit cranky in life, he's a real grump in death. Or at least he is when the witch of Endor disturbs him from his sleep and summons him back to the land of the living. So you can read the story on your own, chapter 28. I promise it's in there. I'm not exaggerating any of it. The spirit of Samuel appears seance style before Saul. And Saul is hoping to hear some good, hopeful news from Samuel. But instead, Samuel, or the spirit of Samuel, drops the hammer on him once and for all. And he says, the time has come. The Lord is going to keep his promise that he made to you when he told you that he was going to tear your kingdom away from you and give it to your neighbor David. It's over. And furthermore, Samuel tells Saul that not only will his army be routed by the Philistines the next day, he, along with his sons fighting in the battle, they will all be killed. It's over for Saul. And then we go back to chapter 9 in the Philistine camp. They're preparing for battle. And the commanders of the Philistine army do not want to fight with David and his men. David made a name for himself initially by killing Philistines. Achish may trust David with his life. They do not, and so Achish sends David home from the battle, but not before David protests and says, would you please just let me have one shot at my enemies? I'm ready to go. But Achish refuses and sends him and his men back to Ziklag, leaving everyone who's ever read this story to wonder, oh, David, were you really going to march into battle with the Philistines and fight the Israelites? The Lord's anointed, you were going to go into battle with the Philistines? But since Achish's loyalty is built upon deception from the very beginning with David, fans of David defend him and assume that, no. He was deceiving Achish one more time. And when the battle started, he was going to flip sides and fight against the Philistines. Of course, that's what he would do. But circumstances keep us from ever knowing David's true intentions. And the narrator never comes back and closes that loop. Who knows? And we don't have a lot of time to dwell on the mystery of David's real intentions, because as soon as he gets back to Ziklag in chapter 30, he finds that the Amalekites, another group of enemies, have attacked the village and they have captured all the men's wives and children and taken them as slaves. David and his men weep themselves dry. And then the men blame David. And they consider stoning him. David's in trouble with his own men. But he's always a man of action. And being the man of action he is, the text says he takes strength in the Lord, inquires of the Lord, and the Lord tells him, yes, go chase the Amalekites down and get your people back. And that's exactly what he does, and he solidifies or fortifies his wobbly credibility as a leader. David's going to be just fine with his men. And now, chapter 31, we're back to Saul one last time. True to Samuel's word, the Philistines defeat the Israelites. Saul's sons, including Jonathan, David's best friend, they're killed in battle, and Saul is mortally wounded. And when he asks his armor bearer to finish him off so that he doesn't fall into the hands of the Philistines, the armor bearer refuses, so Saul falls on his own sword. Terrible death for a king. And the next day, the Philistines find his body and desecrate it and hold it up as a trophy from battle. And thus comes an end to the first scroll of Samuel. And the story ends on a brutal, dark, depressing, messy note. And then you launch into 2 Samuel. That opening section continues to describe how David ascends to the throne, and you quickly see the story does not immediately get better or brighter or cleaner. It's still very messy. In chapter 1, after David laments the loss of Saul and his best friend Jonathan, he's then anointed as king. not of Israel, but of Judah, just a single tribe, Judah in the southern part of Israel. He's anointed as king of one tribe in chapter 2. Meanwhile, loyalists to the house of Saul make his sole surviving son king over the other tribes. And this leads to a bloody, vengeful, violent, messy civil war between the house of Saul and the house of David, led by General Abner from Saul's army and General Joab from David's army. And you can read all about their exploits in 2 Samuel chapters 2 through 4. But I'm warning you, you will not find anything edifying, anything inspirational, anything beautiful in that section of the story. When the dust settles and the blood is done being spilt, it's a muddy mess. David does become the king. And so these events describe that transition, how David finally does become king. Years after initially being anointed to be the next king, when he was a young man, a young boy, in his early teens, and now in his 30s, he's becoming the king. This is how, what I just summarized for you, this is how God tears the kingdom away from Saul and gives it to his neighbor David. Now, isn't that summary statement neat and clean? This is how the kingdom moves from Saul to David. But the events that actually describe it are quite messy. So much so, at times, it's hard to see God working in the story. That's why I told you initially that it was a challenge for me to find something to preach out of this section of the story. So I read through the story and I keep asking myself, okay, God, where are you in this story? What are you doing in this story? Where are you in all of this deception and vengeance and violence and death and blood? Where is God in this story? And there's two tempting answers to that question. The first is kind of moralizing answer that says, well, God is not in enough of the story, and really God needs to be in more of the story. We read the story and we criticize David. I've done some of that in previous sermons. We criticize David for his behavior, his deception, his violence, his vengeance, his political maneuvering, and we take it as a sign that he really doesn't trust God. And David needs to improve his behavior. And we'd also like for the Lord to intervene and call David to a higher standard. But God does not do this in this section of the story. Now, God will have some hard things to say to David later on when he's a king. But in this transition period, God seems to endorse David and his men's brutal behavior. And you feel, oh, if God could just be in a little more of this story, it wouldn't seem so bad. Or at least tell David, knock some of that off. But no, it's not in there. So the other possible answer is maybe God doesn't want to be in the story. Maybe God's not supposed to be in the story. Maybe God drops out from major points or major chunks of the story, and that's the way it's supposed to be. It is interesting to note in chapter 27, when David is living among the Philistines and serving King Achish, the Lord is never mentioned in chapter 27. It's all David. What David is doing in Gath among the Philistines. David on his own. David, a man of action. David taking the initiative. Oh, he's clever and he's cunning. He'll do whatever it takes to survive. And while his ethics are a bit suspect, we respect him as a leader and a hero. God only pops into David's story when absolutely needed. The rest of the time, David is on his own to solve his own problems. But that answer doesn't capture the thrust of the story either. Because this is not David's story. This is not David's story in which God is a bit player, a supporting cast member who pops into the story for a scene or two and then disappears for long periods of time. This is not David's story, and God is not a bit player in it. This is God's story. And God's story is messy. It's messy not because God is not in enough of it or because God chooses to drop out for large chunks of it. It's messy because of the kind of people God includes in his story to play the supporting cast. This section in 1 and 2 Samuel is messy, but let's be honest, it's not the only messy section of the Bible, is it? No, the Bible is messy from beginning to end. God's story is messy from beginning to end. Who made the mess? Not God. But God did make the people who make the messes. And that's why early on in the story, you see God entering into the story to take action, to do something about all these messes that people created in the image of God are making. You see God initiating a plan, taking some action to begin to clean up the mess, but also to teach human beings how to stop making so many messes. And that should be a fairly straightforward story. God has the power to clean up what messes God wants to clean up. He can fix what is broken. He can change whatever God wants to change. And yet, the world is still a very messy place. Why? Because guess who God chooses to partner with to initiate and execute his plan? The mess makers, who run around like hyperactive five-year-olds making messes faster than God can clean them up. I love the way Eugene Peterson poses this problem in this section of 1 and 2 Samuel in his book about David. He says what we're all thinking, or at least what we all should be thinking as we read this part of the story. He says, why does the Bible have to have this stuff in it? Haven't you ever wondered that, especially reading the Old Testament? Why does this kind of stuff have to be in the Bible? If God is working here, why don't things work out better? Why don't people behave better? If God is at the center of things, why does history get so messed up? The answer is quite obvious, even if uncongenial. Peterson says, this is the context, history, and the company, the people, in which God chooses to work out our salvation. This is as good as it gets. The history, the people, this is it. In other words, if God only works with and through good or perfect people in ideal situations, God's work does not get done. If God waits to work only through good or perfect people in ideal situations where no one has mud or blood on their hands or feet, God's work does not get done. So yes, the Bible is messy. Scandalously so, but don't be embarrassed by it. It ought to be messy. The Bible tells a story of God using mess makers to bring peace and order and truth into a chaotic world. Yes, the first 2,000 years of Christian church history is messy, and it ought to be messy. Church history is the story of God using mess makers like us to take the good news of Jesus Christ into a broken world. Yes, this church is messy. It ought to be messy. Because this church is populated, filled with mess makers. Forgiven, redeemed, saved, in the process of being transformed, one step forward, two steps back, mess makers. It's all a mess. The story, this world, this church, my life, your life, our life together, their life out there, their life way over there. It's all a mess. Where is God in it? Well, sometimes it's hard to sense God's presence, hear God's voice, see God's fingerprints in the mess. The good news today is that God is in the middle of this mess with us. He's in the middle of it, with us, walking with us, guiding us, nudging us, prodding us, sometimes pulling us out, sometimes carrying us through, and someday carrying us beyond the mess of our world, of our families, of our lives. I don't know about you, but I think that'll preach.